Hey there, thanks for coming. Take a seat.
Time to retire to the drawing room.
You are what you drink, and you drink where you live, it would seem. New research shows that the closer you live to a pub, the worse off your health is likely to be if, of course, this is the caveat, you live in a disadvantaged area. Sounds complicated. Thankfully, research authors Hannah Badland and Michael Livingston are here to explain. So let me get this right. If you live in a wealthy suburb and you live next to a pub, is your health better off than if you live in a disadvantaged area and you live next to a bottle shop?
Probably it's not quite as simple as that. So what we did was we unpacked it. So sorry about that. But what we did is that we unpacked it in terms of off-licence and on-licence premises. So off-licence is your bottle store, the one that you go and purchase your alcohol and then take it away. Then you've got your on-licence, which is your restaurants, your cafes, places where you actually drink in situ. So what we found is that it was all around distance. So if you're around, it's about 800 metres around a bottle store within 800 metres for those more disadvantaged communities, there's a negative effect on self-rated health. So they're more likely to report bad self-rated health, which is a really stable measure of physical and mental health, which holds across what we call a socioeconomic spectrum. So it works for people who are very disadvantaged, right through to people who are very advantaged. And then equally, when we look at things on licensed premises, what we see is it's a closer, so sort of around 400 metres. We see that there is people who are living in more disadvantaged communities are tending to report greater odds of self-rated health when there are those on licensed premises around them.
And what's the relationship to wealth? Why are we talking about the socioeconomic spectrum here?
So one thing we did do in the study is that we actually controlled for independent wealth factors, so things such as education, age, household income. But there's some area level, I guess, different types of areas have different attributes, for want of a better word. So what the reason why we were looking at it is that we do know that there's patterning with alcohol outlets, and Michael can probably talk to this a lot more, but areas that tend to be more disadvantaged often have more outlets in there. They tend to have high levels of crime. Crime's been related to, obviously, violence, mental health, physical health. So it's quite interesting to actually understand the area level impacts, because people live in these communities, and we need to actually sort of move away, I think, from the individual and actually understand what the impact is on people who live there rather than people who come into the area, have drinks or have dinner or whatever they might do. Just sort of understand that a little bit more and help reduce health inequity.
I'll bring you in here, Dr. Michael Livingston. And in those disadvantaged areas, is your health worse off because you drink more, or is it because there are other health factors at play in those areas? Because really, I mean, just applying some logic here, I imagine the reason that your health is bad in areas of disadvantage are a lot more complex than just your access to drinking.
Yeah, and certainly the research evidence is pretty clear that people who live in poor neighbourhoods don't drink more than those who live in rich neighbourhoods. It's a pretty level gradient across the socioeconomic spectrum, alcohol consumption. But it's also clear that people who have less social supports, who have lower incomes, who are living in poor neighbourhoods, suffer more negative consequences from their drinking. So they're likely getting in more trouble for the same amount of drinking for reasons that are to do with the kind of social structures. So there's scope for improvements in those outcomes, even beyond alcohol policy, just by dealing with some of the inequities.
Michael, I read somewhere recently that it's not so much our drinking culture that's the problem. It's our macho culture combined with the drinking. In fact, I think research shows that our consumption in Australia has remained constant, but alcohol-related harm has increased. So why would that be?
It's a real puzzle that we're seeing increasing harm while consumption is in fact declining over the last 5 or 6 years. And some of it is probably about measurement, but some of it is about the kind of things that we associate with drinking and drunkenness. So in Australia, if you get drunk, it's almost acceptable for that to lead to kind of aggression, whereas in some cultures, aggression and drunkenness are not so closely linked. There are cultural factors that underpin some of these things, but our consumption is still reasonably high as well. So you've got to deal with both the kind of attitudes towards drinking and the amount that we drink, I think, to really reduce harm.
All right, let's get to some solutions. How do we make our drinking culture better for our health?
There's not good evidence really anywhere in the world of policy or government programs that aim to change the drinking culture and have a positive effect. We do have good evidence from things like tobacco in Australia and things like road safety, drink driving, that really to produce like genuine health gains, you need a kind of combination of cultural shifts via public education and marketing and legislative restrictions. So you see with tobacco the kind of step between, you know, increased taxes, reduced places they can be sold, and run these big campaigns and education programs. And really the tobacco culture, such as it is in Australia now, is just transformed from what it was 20 years ago.
And can I just jump in with this one too? One of the components of the study was to actually analyse all the state-level alcohol policies that were in existence. So we looked at five different states and territories. We were looking at what we call spatial policy, so they're things that are actually spatially attributable. And what we found was that there was pretty much nothing there, apart from a couple of states had policies around not having alcohol outlets around schools. So policymakers actually don't have anything that they can go. So when they get been challenged in court with alcohol outlets, for example, they don't have the evidence to go, well, no, we can't do this because X, Y, and Z will happen. So at the moment, I think decisions have almost been made on an ad hoc basis, and then they're often overturned because the evidence isn't there to support it. So we think that's one of the impacts of this paper, this whole project. It's been overarched by an advisory group which does have our stakeholders, our policymakers, both federal and state. So we hope that our research is actually going to inform policy and get some teeth around it, rather than these almost more off-the-cuff decisions or overturning of decisions that we're seeing quite a lot.
Well, how can we change our built environment then to improve health and alcohol outcomes, Hannah, without, if I can put this, build this into the question, because this is often the attack we hear, and I think it has some intellectual rigour to it. We don't want to become a nanny state either. We want to give people the right to make decisions about what they do in their lives. There's almost an inherent contradiction, isn't there? Because we also want people to live healthy lives.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think the nanny state, to me, is a bit of a popular discourse, I think. What I think we should be trying to optimise is how do we create health promotion environments that reduce inequity? Because when you look at the economic productivity of people who are more disadvantaged, that they're not contributing as much to the economy, there's social isolation, there's such a raft of downstream impacts that it's about how do we actually protect health and protect social inclusion and reduce inequity. And it's not saying don't do something. I mean, again, tobacco is a really good example. It hasn't come out and stopped people smoking. It's created an environment which supports health-promoting behaviours. People can still make the choice. People are rational human beings. People will continue to make choices based on what their beliefs are and what they wish to do. But how do we create the infrastructure that supports optimal outcomes for most people?
On RN Drive, my two guests are Dr. Hannah Badland. She's from the Mackaykee Vic Health Community Wellbeing Unit at the University of Melbourne. And Dr. Michael Livingston, Research Fellow at the Centre for Alcohol Policy Research at La Trobe University. You've both worked on this very big project to look at the differences between the rich and the poor, if you like, disadvantaged people and non-disadvantaged people, and access to alcohol outlets. Would you advocate, Hannah, for a reduction in bottle-os, as they're known?
Those disadvantaged areas? It should be considered how many there are existing. So let's say if someone wants to put in request a licence for a new off-licence, I think it should be taken in context. Are there already four bottle stores there, or are there none? If there's none, well, maybe you could argue that, but do you need four or five? So I think, again, it's context specific, but it's providing the evidence that if this type of environment is created, these are the likely impacts. And keeping in mind, this is looking at self-rated health, but there's such a wide body of evidence that looks at violence, crime, like the more immediate impacts, accidents, look at any police or ambulance data.
Would it make a difference? Would people just travel further for alcohol, particularly people with alcohol problem?
It's the kind of policy intervention that would make a gradual difference. If you look at Victoria, for example, we've seen over the past decade a massive increase in the amount of bottle shops and other kinds of alcohol outlets. And any kind of policy change is not going to undo those things in the short term, but it may stem some of the growth and it may start to shift those patterns. And certainly the growth has been concentrated for bottle shops in poor neighbourhoods. So we do see kind of a clustering of bottle shops in poor neighbourhoods. We see a clustering of problems in poor neighbourhoods, similar to the gambling story. I mean, it's a common theme, and really the current frameworks legislatively make it very difficult for councils or communities to object to one of these new licences and have some say over their community's structure.
So in that context, Michael, do we need legislative changes around urban planning to improve health outcomes?
I mean, the answer to that probably varies a bit by jurisdiction. I know in Western Australia, for example, the onus is put on an applicant to demonstrate that this licence is of some benefit to the community, whereas in Victoria and other states, I think, the onus is on the community to demonstrate the harm. And so in that situation, you find in Victoria, very few communities can successfully overturn these applications.
Is that because they don't have the resources to mount a case or because it's just too labour intensive?
It's a combination. The opponents are always very well resourced companies, the big bottle shop chains in particular. But also the legislation kind of in some ways constrains the issues that can be considered. So in a planning sense, the focus is really around amenity. So you can't really talk about health as an outcome in a planning hearing. It's got to be about noise or litter or something that kind of fits into this planning framework of amenity. So we do argue for kind of a broader consideration of community impact when we're talking about making good licensing decisions.
Have people ever been successful at saying, for instance, this drinking venue, this bottle shop, looking at the violence consequences, there could be more violence in our community? Has anyone been able to mount that argument?
Again, yeah, certainly in different jurisdictions, different levels of success. There's been a couple recently in New South Wales where councils have knocked back Dan Murphy's and that stood up to appeals. In Victoria, it's very unusual for a licence to be completely rejected. Often the compromise ends up being conditions put on the licence in terms of their trading hours or the kind of products they might sell. But generally speaking, it's very hard for communities in Victoria to succeed.
Dr. Hannah Badland, I wonder, we, as you mentioned, smoking, we've come to this point in the tobacco discussion where we accept very broadly as a community that there needs to be a lot of limitations around tobacco. We haven't had that same reckoning with alcohol. Will we?
I don't know. I think a cultural shift would be advantageous. Whether or not it will become something the movement as large as what tobacco is, I'm not sure. But I think, because you do have very high population of people drinking, and I think even just an occasional drink, a lot of people do just drink. And I think probably the issue between, or the difference between cigarettes and alcohol is that one glass of wine a night likely won't actually cause that much harm. But compared with one cigarette, there are substantial negative health impacts that are known very clearly. I think that's probably part of it, that where do you see it? But there are some safe drinking guidelines that have come up from the NHMRC. So that would be at least one thing to be striving for, is to try to get them, particularly around, you know, whether or not it's appropriate for people to be intoxicated in bars and restaurants. Often you do see that on licensed premises, so whether or not that's a tightening up of some of the legislative monitoring of that. I think it would be challenging in terms of equating it to tobacco.
Michael, are other legislative changes any use? I mean, I know in the US, obviously, they have the drinking age at 21. Is that something that could be useful?
There's very good evidence from the US that it did make a difference in terms of things like traffic accidents and some violence outcomes as well. I mean, all these decisions are more than just about health. They're kind of political and they're about different sets of values. And one of the good news stories in Australia at the moment, at least, is that youth drinking is really on the way down. So it's probably not a policy I'd be looking towards in the short term.
Do we know if it's been replaced by anything else, though?
Not in terms of illicit drugs. There's no evidence that Australian young people are using more cannabis, for example. So we're not sure what's going on with young people today. They've really seem to be straightening up and flying right.
But our young people are awesome.
In a policy sense, we do know, for example, that the late trading hour restrictions that have come in King's Cross and before that Newcastle have had a real impact on rates of violence. So there are policy measures we can implement that will reduce the negative consequences without it even necessarily affecting drinking.
Hannah, it's about improving inequality broadly. You talked about the broader inequality discussion. If we fix that, we fix a lot of related problems,
Absolutely.
Don't we?
Absolutely. And it's a tough ask. Yeah. Inequities, they're very vast. They've happened for numerous reasons, intergenerational issues, entrenched biases, whatever it might be. But when there's a lot of evidence now that's coming up that's focused on inequity and actually reducing what's going on, and the economic benefits are just so vast. So even people who call the nanny state and take more of the attitude, well, people deserve it, which is often a comment you do hear of someone who maybe is more disadvantaged. The evidence just stacks up that if we have a flatter society where more people are equal, everyone does better. That's really where we want to be going. Multifaceted alcohol outlets aren't probably going to resolve that by itself, but it's about the way that we think, and particularly when we are putting in planning policies, to actually keep in mind who are the most disadvantaged and what will be the unintended consequences if we do go forward with option A instead of option B, and actually having a discussion about it and being okay to unpack it a little bit more.
We've started the conversation tonight. I hope it continues. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's Dr. Michael Livingston, Research Fellow at the Centre for Alcohol Policy Research at La Trobe University, and Dr. Hannah Badland from the Makaki Vic Health Community Wellbeing Unit at the University of Melbourne.